This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 26th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. The 63rd Annual Opera in the Ozarks is offering performances now through July 19th at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs, with Sunday performances scheduled for the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville June 30th, July 7th, and July 14th at 4 p.m. 2013 productions include Pirates of Penzance, Madama Butterfly, and Elixir of Love. Tickets and more information available at opera.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, an update on an agreement between Arkansas and Oklahoma to improve the Illinois River watershed. Plus, a preview of the annual Cancer Challenge fundraising event in Bella Vista, a tour of the second phase of construction at Fayetteville High School, a forum focused on the possibility of a growing green economy in the Arkansas and Mississippi Delta regions, and more.
But first, Home Bank Shares, owner of Centennial Bank, announced yesterday afternoon it is acquiring Liberty Bank Shares of Jonesboro. The merger of the two companies will double the number of Centennial Bank branches from 46 to 92 locations around the state. There are also branches in Alabama and Florida. John Allison, chairman of Home Bank Shares, calls this a historic moment.
In our careers, we both ended up building two powerful banking organizations, and the right time came, and now the time is here, and Wallace and I have grasped this opportunity. It makes me very proud to announce the largest in-state banking transaction in the history of the state of Arkansas.
Governor Mike Beebe also attended the announcement, remarking on how well both banks have handled problems that national banks have been struggling with.
Arkansas banks never struggled. Well, we had a few hiccups, and we had some, but compared to what happened nationally, our community banks in Arkansas are solid, they're safe, they're well-run.
After completing the merger, the combined company will have more than $7 billion in total assets and about 1,500 employees around the state.
Head Start programs in Washington County will have room for 66 fewer students in the coming school year, as effects of the federal sequestration have forced the Economic Opportunity Agency, the organization responsible for Head Start programs in the county, to make cuts. Brenda Zedlitz is the Director of Children's Services for EOA of Washington County. She says the agency knew with a smaller budget cuts were necessary, so enrollment data was used to find where the cuts would affect the least amount of people.
Head Starts are designed to be in the neighborhoods where the children that live around that center can come to that center, be within walking distance preferably. And so when we looked at the population in Washington County that we were serving in Head Start, the Willow Heights Center is not where Head Start eligible children live. It used to be, but the population that is eligible for Head Start with the younger children have now moved out closer to Weddington. And this probably had a lot to do with when the Jefferson Elementary School was closed, because that was where a lot of children went to elementary school, so we had a big population right around the south part of Fayetteville.
Zedlitz says aside from the closure of two classrooms, one at Willow Heights in Fayetteville and another in Lincoln, and the decrease in possible enrollment, the cuts will have other, more intangible effects on the children served by Head Start, who are members of families that are at 100% of the federal poverty level or below.
These are children who are going to be adversely affected, who already have a lot of situations in their life which are placing them at risk for school failure, family situations. Poverty is the biggest issue that most of our families face. So having their children in a safe place every day, their children being fed two meals and two snacks every day, and then all of the educational and family development services that we provide to reduce the achievement gap, get those kiddos ready to start kindergarten on the same footing as their peers, this is going to affect the number of children and the impact of our services in Washington County.
In addition, the classroom closures will mean six staff members will have to be let go. Zedlitz says barring an increased budget from the federal government, it would take a donation of $150,000 for the classrooms to reopen.
The Walton Family Foundation has announced continued support to Teach for America with a $4.3 million grant that will go directly to the TFA Delta region that serves Arkansas and Mississippi. A previous grant from the foundation supported more than 550 core members in 125 schools during the 2012-2013 school year, reaching more than 45,000 students. This most recent investment will continue that support and increase the number of core members placed in the region during the next 2 years, resulting in 582 placements this fall and more than 600 next year. We'll have more news from the Delta region later on this edition of Ozarks.
Arkansas health and agriculture officials report they have isolated and contained a mild strain of bird flu found on a farm in Scott County. The 8 birds that had the virus were euthanized and their eggs were destroyed. Dustin Clark, a veterinarian with the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture, says poultry owners must promote basic hygiene and sanitation practices to prevent the spread of avian influenza and other diseases.
Of course, a lot of people that have small flocks, they may have them for exhibition purposes. If you do show your birds at a county fair or a state fair, you want to be sure that when you bring those birds home that you isolate them away from your other birds for a minimum of 3 weeks. It's best if you'll go 30 days. The incubation period is such with poultry diseases that most often they'd break within that 3-week period.
State officials say the strain of avian flu found in western Arkansas does not pose a threat to humans.
Campgrounds in western Arkansas at Lake Washita, DeGray Lake, and Lake Greeson reopened yesterday. High water and flooding caused the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to close the parks last week. Bill Jackson, a park ranger at Lake Washita, says high water at the lakes is actually a sign flood damage reduction strategies are working by preventing water from threatening vulnerable areas downstream.
Of course, the primary purpose for Lake Washita and Blakely Mountain Dam is flood control, flood reduction on downstream areas. So therefore, we were holding the waters that were coming in through the Washita River and through the tributaries around Lake Washita.
Rising waters did not catch authorities off guard, leaving time for preparations and warning to visitors. Authorities have been vigilant in dealing with potential flooding since 20 people died during a flash flood 3 years ago at the Albert Pike Recreational Area in southwest Arkansas.
The National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat warning for several Oklahoma counties and for Crawford, Sebastian, and Franklin counties in Arkansas. According to the advisory, well above seasonal average temperatures combined with a very moist low-level environment will produce dangerous heat conditions across the region during the next several days, creating a situation in which heat illnesses can occur. The heat advisory is in effect until 7 p.m. Friday.
So, partly cloudy with lows in the lower to mid-70s tonight, winds from the south-southwest at about 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, hot, sunny. Highs will be in the mid-90s in northwest Arkansas, up to 100 in the Arkansas River Valley. Heat index values between 103 and 109. And then tomorrow night, partly cloudy, slight chance of rain. Lows will be in the mid-70s in northwest Arkansas, around 77 tomorrow night for the Arkansas River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. For years, the state of Oklahoma has battled with Arkansas in the press and courts to reduce water pollution in the Illinois River. The river starts in northwest Arkansas, a region congested with urban development and poultry farms, before crossing into Oklahoma at Siloam Springs. The river has been declared impaired by the Environmental Protection Agency under the Clean Water Act. This winter, both states renewed an agreement to work together to improve the watershed, a strategic move to deter litigation. But shortly after, Arkansas industrial interests attempted to disrupt the process. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The problem, Arkansas has long argued, is that Oklahoma is being overly strict about water quality in the Illinois River. On the Oklahoma side, the river is categorized as scenic and recreational and is strictly regulated. On the Arkansas side, the river is not. Still, both states have done due diligence creating laws and best management practices to remove sources of pollutants from the river, including phosphorus, which causes oxygen-depleting algae blooms. Phosphorus is concentrated in raw municipal wastewater, as well as in poultry farm waste spread on fields as pasture fertilizer. Oklahoma Water Resources Board in 2001 set an in-stream numeric limit of 0.037 milligrams per liter of phosphorus and signed a pact a year later with Arkansas to work together to clean the watershed. As a consequence, Arkansas poultry farms on the Illinois River watershed have been forced to limit the use of bird waste as fertilizer, and municipal wastewater treatment plants have invested millions of dollars upgrading their sewage treatment plants. Phosphorus levels have dramatically decreased, but not enough, says Oklahoma. So in 2005, then-Oklahoma Attorney General Drew Edmondson filed suit against a flock of Arkansas poultry companies for polluting the million-acre watershed. The decision is still pending. Meanwhile, that phosphorus pact struck 10 years ago, formerly referred to as the Statement of Joint Principles, expired. And Arkansas was set to sue Oklahoma for holding to what it considered an unscientific and capricious water quality standard. Oh, it's also complicated. But determined to end the feud once and for all, attorneys general from both states joined forces quietly late last year to fix the mess. And in February, the pact was extended for 3 more years. So in the coming weeks, both Governor Mike Beebe and Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon will announce appointments to a 6-member joint committee to oversee water quality studies by an independent lab to determine phosphorus criteria based on an EPA-approved testing method called the stressor response.
I've made some recommendations to the governor on some people who I think would do a good job.
That's Randy Young. He's a longtime executive director of the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission, which has oversight on poultry farm waste. And it was the poultry integrators who agreed to foot the bill for this study, budgeted at $600,000.
It's coming from the cities in northwest Arkansas, from the poultry companies, and from the state.
But after the agreement was signed this winter, Tyson and Simmons Food, along with the Poultry Federation, Rogers Lowell Chamber of Commerce, and Northwest Arkansas Council, sent letters to EPA Region 6 requesting the agency suspend research it's been conducting to develop a total maximum load for phosphorus on the Illinois River Basin. In an email response for this report, Tyson spokesperson Gary Michelson stated that Oklahoma's phosphorus standard was arbitrarily set, but now that the two states have agreed to discover a scientific measure, it makes sense to wait for the results, saving stakeholders money, to which Randy Young agrees.
So I think it makes good sense to hold up on completing the TMDL study while the stressor response study is being conducted, which essentially is going to evaluate whether or not the 0.037 is the right number.
According to internal documents, EPA Region 6 Administrator Ron Curry responded to the letters by stating that EPA's TMDL study will continue and that the current phosphorus criterion will remain in effect until the two-state study is complete. Over the years, Arkansas's poultry companies, as a goodwill gesture towards Oklahoma, have donated more than $1.1 million to the Oklahoma Scenic Rivers Commission. Established in 1977, the commission works to protect the aesthetic, scenic, historic, archaeological, and scientific features of the Illinois River and its tributaries. Administrator Ed Feit also serves on the state's water board.
In Oklahoma, our scenic rivers are afforded the highest and best water quality protection that our state can leverage or bring to bear. And they are called scenic rivers, but under our water quality standards, they're outstanding resource waters. In Arkansas, the best water quality in the state of Arkansas is extraordinary resource waters, ERW waters. And the Illinois River in Arkansas is not.
Still, Ed Feit says he's encouraged Arkansas is willing to find a consensus.
I want to compliment Arkansas because when they came to start negotiating this, and I wasn't involved in a lot of the discussions, but the state of Arkansas, to take some of the friction out of the negotiations and the work that was going on, offered to pay for the study.
As for the letter submitted by Arkansas agricultural and municipal interests to delay federal pollution limits?
None of them who wrote those letters were parties to the 2003 agreement, nor the 2013 extension. Now, when I say parties, they weren't involved with the discussions, negotiations, and what led to the inking of those agreements. So I felt that their letters to EPA urging that they suspend the established TMDL should be disregarded. Okay. Also in their letters, the Northwest Arkansas civic interests and companies that wrote those letters somewhat misrepresented the extension of the agreement between the two states. And I'll boil it down just as simply as I can. The second agreement is simply a three-year extension of the 2003 Arkansas-Oklahoma Statement of Joint Principles and Actions. And it was, for the majority, crafted to avoid costly and protracted litigation and administrative hearings that would undermine the huge successes that have been accomplished since the first agreement was inked in 2003.
Finally, there's that 8-year-old poultry industry lawsuit filed by former Oklahoma Attorney General Drew Edmondson, which could cost companies millions and millions of dollars in damages. The trial, heard by Judge Gregory Frizzell in U.S. District Court in Tulsa, involved 60 witnesses, 600 exhibits, and yielded 2,900 legal filings. Since its conclusion in the winter of 2010, a ruling has yet to be issued. There was talk several years ago the lawsuit would be dropped when Republican Governor Mary Fallon was elected, but it's still in play. But Oklahoma Scenic Rivers Commission Administrator Ed Feit believes the case will be abandoned.
It's been almost 4 years since the case was concluded, the arguments concluded, and there still hasn't been a decision issued. I don't think there will be. I think that it's a very complicated case, and that whichever way that the judge would rule, he's going to be bombarded. And so we may never see a ruling in this particular lawsuit.
So now, the next chapter on Oklahoma versus Arkansas and the Illinois River Basin commences. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Every year since 1993, the Cancer Challenge in Bella Vista has raised money to benefit area cancer programs and services for local residents. The previous incarnations have raised more than $9.5 million, and organizers think this year's three-day event that begins Thursday will raise more than $600,000 for five separate agencies, including Hope Cancer Resources in Springdale and Washington Regional's Cancer Support Home in Fayetteville and Bentonville. While the format of the Cancer Challenge has changed from time to time since 1993, one thing remains at the core: a connection to outdoor sports. This year, there are races, 5 and 10K runs, plus a one-mile fun walk. There are tennis tournaments and golf tournaments as well. And Friday, at the Highlands Gun Range, there is a trap shooting tournament. As a June Tuesday afternoon fades into evening, the Highlands Gun Range is about as quiet as it ever is. A few shooters sit near the range talking. One of them is Chuck Sharp of Bentonville. He's been involved with the Cancer Challenge for several years and is also the president of the Arkansas State Trap Shooting Federation. He's the perfect resource to find out more about a sport that's experiencing significant growth in Arkansas. He says he became interested in the sport in the mid-1970s.
Back in the years ago, we had what we would call local turkey shoots, you know, just a country thing out in the field, you know, behind a couple of bales of hay. And there was a guy that took me under his wing and helped me experience that.
Trap shooting is related to, but different than, skeet shooting, though both use clay targets. In trap, the targets are launched from a single location and generally fly away from the shooter. In skeet, they can be launched from two separate locations and have a crisscross pattern. Steady hands and good eyes help a shooter, but Chuck Sharp says the good news is that the best trap shooters have learned to be better.
Yeah, all those things you just mentioned, but trap shooting is a learned skill. It's not like, you know, when you and I were born, we were either fast or we weren't fast. We could do some things to increase our quickness, but not our speed. So trap shooting is a learned skill. It doesn't matter if you're big or tall or short or round or whatever, you know. So the biggest thing of it is this, that if you have the drive and determination that you want to improve, and if you work at it hard enough, you can accomplish it.
Like so many activities that rely on repetition, hitting a golf ball, throwing the curveball, or rolling a 16-pound bowling ball down the lane, shooting requires good form. And though you're pulling the trigger with your finger, the key to racking up a good score is in the legs.
In golf, you know, you have a swing that you build on, and in trap shooting, we have our stance is where we start, and start with that foundation, because the shot takes place basically between the knees and the waist and stuff, and not the arms and things like that. So you build that proper foundation, you establish that, then you build on it as you go.
More than 100 individuals, about 34 teams, had registered for the Cancer Challenge Trap Shooting Tournament by late last week. Organizers say the tournament has grown each year, and Chuck Sharp says that's not surprising since the sport is enjoying a boom in Arkansas. He says the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission began an effort just a few years ago to get more young people interested in outdoor sports, and trap shooting was an emphasis of that project.
And what's happened out of this, a lot of these, our youth have gone on to shoot competitively. This last year we had 5 All-Americans make the All-American team. We had 2 have qualified for the Olympics. We'll be competing in Peru and in Brazil this summer. It's just, we are, every year at the Grand American, which is in Sparta, Illinois, the last few years it's been Arkansas. You know, these young people are hitting the leaderboard, and so all the trap shooting nation, they're saying, what's going on in Arkansas? What's all this all about? You know, it's this Arkansas youth sports shooting program that's fueling this thing.
Chuck says the Arkansas State Trap Shooting Federation has seen the youth participation grow from 500 participants the first year of the program to more than 6,000 a year now. Just like that new putter or those specialized running shoes can set you back, though, Chuck says the amount a person spends on trap shooting is, well, up to the individual.
Well, that's a big number. Today in the trap shooting world, the competition world out there, you know, a lot of trap guns run from $5,000 to $20,000 or greater.
Which means, of course, if you miss more targets than you hit, you can blame that cheap rifle, right?
It's the Indian, not the arrow. I think I can honestly say that I have never missed a target because of the gun.
Okay.
I've never missed a target because of the shell. I know that if I put the shot on the target, it will break. Now, and like in golf, a lot of times, you know, we try to look for this magic ball, this new set of golf clubs that's going to really improve our game. But that's such a small part of it.
The competition in the Cancer Challenge Trap Shooting Tournament begins at 8 a.m. Friday at the Highland Gun Range in Bella Vista. The 3-day Cancer Challenge itself begins tomorrow afternoon with a junior tennis clinic and tournament at the Kingsdale Tennis Complex. Along with the sports, there is a gala, the Sparkle and Spurs Gala, which will take place Friday night at Horton Farms in Gravett. You can learn much more about the events and the local agencies that benefit from the money raised at cancerchallenge.com. And to learn more about the Arkansas State Trap Shooting Federation, you can go online to arkansastrapshooting.org. It is Wednesday, the 26th of June, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor of Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Weren't we just talking about music?
It seems like we talked about that a lot yesterday.
But on a completely different note, what could be more summer than outdoor concerts?
I love outdoor concerts.
Don't you, though?
It is. It's
hot dog, pizza. It's great fun. And tomorrow night at Gully Park, as part of the annual Gully Park Concert Series, Roscoe Bandana from Mississippi will perform. The Facebook page says the band's sound is blues Americana-style music blended with modern folk and a hint of gypsy fanfare.
Very interesting.
It does sound good. They're going to play at Yonder Mountain String Band's Harvest Music Festival this fall, too.
Oh, excellent.
But tomorrow night, it's free.
Tomorrow night, it's free at 7 o'clock at Gully Park in Fayetteville. And also, tomorrow night is Lee and the Mojo Doctors at 8 o'clock at Powerhouse in Fayetteville.
How fun.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And sometimes, for what I consider good reason, I have been verbally abusive towards the deer.
A few days later, Tom called me. When are you going to come get the car? I said, I have the car. Tom said, I'm looking at the car.
Oh, my God. Would I soon be blowing smoke rings at Nurse Green Eyes?
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
And the summer of music for our region continues. Tonight, the Fayetteville Public Library kicks off. You know, they just finished their And you're the person who has this title memorized. They just
maybe
finished.
the Mountain Street Stage June Music Series.
Yes, they just finished that.
They just finished that.
Now, tonight, they're kicking off a six-week series called America's Music, a film history of our popular music from blues to bluegrass to Broadway. They say the series is designed to enlighten audiences about the uniquely American musical genres. That includes blues and gospel, Broadway, jazz, bluegrass, country, rock and roll, hip-hop, mambo, just to name some of them. They're going to be free concerts Sunday at 2, so it's like the series that just ended.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Robert Cochran, Bob, who I used to co-host the North Arkansas Music Awards with
spring,
and he's the chair of American Studies at the University of Arkansas. He's also the director of the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies. He's the project scholar for the program. He's going to be leading discussions following each of the films that will be taking place in these series.
Mm-hmm.
The Sunday concerts will begin this Sunday afternoon at 2. They're free.
At the Fayetteville Public Library. Is it in the...
I'm assuming it's in Walker.
Walker Community Room.
Right. And this week, to start it off, it's O.C. Fisher,
mm-hmm.
the O.C. Fisher Band, and we'll have them on the show Friday. They came into the Furman mm-hmm. Garner, and perhaps the loudest band we've had in the building yet.
Perhaps. There was that one traveling band that Katie had,
yes.
Killer Bob. They
yes.
were very loud as well.
Yes. So we
different kind of loud.
Yeah. So we will have a brief conversation with O.C. and a performance from her that was recorded inside Furman Garner. That will be on Friday's show. The concert at the library is Sunday. If you want to know more about that entire series, go to faylib.org.
Mm-hmm. And during the month of June, kids are out of school, want things to do. You can also do some good while entertaining the kids this summer. The Jones Center is collecting non-perishable food items for the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank, and they're offering an ice skating special to those who donate. So you bring in one non-perishable food item plus $2, and that's all you need to skate at the Jones Center this June. Skating is usually $5 a session with a $2 skate rental.
So you're saving like $5
mm-hmm.
if you bring in the perishable non-perishable food item.
Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Do you just bring them to the Jones Center?
You do. It's taking place at the Jones Center until the 30th, at which time they're going to take it to the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank. Now, you can also just donate items without ice skating.
Sure.
You can just
bring them. Collection.
It's a collection point, so it's awesome. And you can find out more at the JonesCenter.net. Excuse me. And speaking of ice,
yes.
in Springdale,
yes.
police are writing tickets for children, and it's actually a good thing. In partnership with Shave the Planet,
mm-hmm.
which is nice, like a shaved ice place.
Right.
Springdale police officers are issuing kids who do the right thing a ticket for free shaved ice.
What's the right thing?
Well, the right thing could be something like wearing a helmet while riding a bike, looking both ways before crossing the road, or maybe picking up a piece of trash.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
so if you get in the habit of doing something and a Springdale police officer sees you,
right.
he may come over and say,
here's a ticket. The ticket will be for one free shaved ice of any size, any flavors, or any toppings.
Awesome.
Supplies are limited, and the kids can't just ask for the tickets. It's all about doing the right thing, even when you don't think anyone is looking.
Oh.
So it sounds like fun. It's in yes. Springdale. Sounds like a good time.
See? Not jaywalking pays off.
Jaywalking wasn't in that list. I'm just saying.
Looking both ways across the street at a
Though
crosswalk.
Though kids
okay.
should look both yes. ways before crossing the street yes. at a crosswalk, yes.
Now, continuing conversation about younger people, Fayetteville High School is in phase two of its construction.
Mm-hmm. Got to take a tour of phase one last year at some point.
Right. And there was a tour recently of phase two, which mm-hmm. will be done by the time school begins later this summer.
Yes. And the plan is to be completely done by the fall of 2015.
Right.
But this next portion will be done by the time the kids come back in August.
Emily Golahan, who is our intern this summer
mm-hmm.
at Ozarks at Large, took the tour.
Yes. And you've been hearing her on the air already. She's right. been producing some spots for us
during the weekend and
mm-hmm.
during, I think, Talk of the Nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So this, and you'll also hear her some this summer during Ozarks at Large.
Yes.
So here is Emily's story about the progress of the construction at Fayetteville High School.
Incoming students at Fayetteville High School can expect exciting new additions this fall from phase two of the school's transformation. The tour of the new facilities revealed new offices for the administration, a media center, new classrooms, and lots of big windows with wonderful views.
Oh, it's so gorgeous.
The first
Wow.
Very nice.
After the full transformation is complete, this won't be your average public high school. In fact, it isn't your average public high school now. Students already saw improvements in the form of a new cafeteria, performing arts hall, and athletic facilities last fall, and that was just phase one. At the end of the transformation, in fall of 2015, the project will have cost $96 million. Public Information Officer of Fayetteville Public Schools, Alan Wilborn, says that this is just the beginning of Phase 2.
This Phase 2 has three sections, and this section will open this August, and then August of 14, and then the entire project will be finished August of 15.
This part of Phase 2 is going to give the students of Fayetteville High School a higher-tech learning experience. District Project Manager Patty Plummer says that the new classrooms allow students to be wired in.
As we continue through the construction process and we get ready to open in August of this year, 2013, you're going to see it slowly transform into a lecture hall that has seats, and at each seat there's power and network. So we'll have the ability for each student to bring in the laptop, whether or not it's one of their own personal devices or whether it's one that's provided by the high school campus, and they'll be able to get onto the network hardwire.
And if the new media center and cool classrooms weren't enough, the new additions to the school include areas called social commons, complete with TVs, for the students' downtime.
In the mornings when they come into school and they just want to hang out before they have to go to class, you know, perhaps after school if they want to hang out. Again, during lunch, you know, you have an hour lunch. The second half could be a club meeting. They could come in the social commons and have a club meeting.
All of these new additions are providing a better experience for students, says Director of Marketing Holly Johnson, who has a daughter entering the school this fall.
I think the freshness, the openness, the spaces that will inspire the collaboration is what they're probably looking forward to.
Students will experience the new facilities this fall, and more the fall after that, and the fall after that. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Emily Gallahan.
The forums, competitions, and conversations about entrepreneurship and growing a green economy are abundant in this part of Arkansas. Now, a program designed to start such discussions in the economically strapped Arkansas Delta are beginning. Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin-Motes has this story about how the rest of the state is helping foster talks and hopefully action for green economic growth in the Delta.
The Delta Green Community Forum, Visions of Green Jobs and Renewable Energy, will take place this coming Friday, June 28th at East Arkansas Community College in Forest City. Free and open to the public, this forum will bring together community activists, green organizers, sustainable entrepreneurs, and everyday people wanting to know more about the possibilities of a growing green economy in the Arkansas and Mississippi Delta regions. Brandon Booth with the UAMS Office of Public Health has been working closely with the Delta Citizens Alliance to organize this forum. The Delta Citizens Alliance is an organization committed to bringing people together to talk about the Delta's future. The forum, Booth explained, was inspired by the Alliance's director, Larry Williams, who wanted to create a space to bring people together from both the public and private sectors to talk about not only the importance of green economies, but also to explore the key concepts of sustainability.
You know, he recognizes that he's not an expert in the field of renewable energy and sustainability. When he came down to the forum, he definitely wanted to define, what is this? Want to know. I'm not the expert in this area, and I want people come to the forum who also are not the expert, and they're coming here because they just want to generally know what are these topics.
The forum is an outgrowth of two previous gatherings, the Delta Green Expo and Going Green in the Delta. The forum will seek to build connections and identify best practices while also engaging community leaders and residents in larger conversations about the economic and community importance of building cleaner energy futures.
There can definitely be more incentives in Arkansas to encourage sustainable practices, but that's happening within Central Arkansas. But within the Delta, that's not there. So within the Delta, we recognize that if you can kind of bring those practices into the Delta, things that you can do, you can create jobs. We can create sustainable jobs, such as if you bring a composting factory into the Delta. Composting and considering that the Delta produces millions of dollars of cash crop, but all that money might not just stay in the community. If you can have, you know, composting factory where now you have farmers within the Delta who are going to the local, you know, factory for, you know, fertilizer. Now you have where the farmers within the Delta, they're not going to have to go spend millions of dollars of outsourcing. And they can just stay in the state, keep the money in the state, and now you're creating jobs with people within the Delta.
Topics covered in the forum include not only agriculture, but also renewable energies, weatherization, pollution prevention, regional solutions, and the overlapping roles that businesses, faith-based work, and community organizing perspectives can play in building sustainable economies. Speakers include William Ball, founder of the Arkansas Renewable Energy Association, Ronald Hughes, coordinator of sustainability and energy sector programs at Pulaski Technical College, and Linda Smith of the Arkansas chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. The speakers, explains Booth, come from a variety of different backgrounds, but all are stakeholders in building a greener future for Arkansas.
And Dr. Barry Colley, he's not a native of Ford City, but he's definitely has his organization, Seven Harvest, there, and he has been consistently trying to figure out, you know, how can you incorporate ingenuity from sustainable practice into agriculture to improve length of production. We have the keynote tomorrow, Dr. Samisha Hora. He is from Strategic Biomass Solutions, and what he's going to be able to provide is definitely a way on how can organizations, either profit, for-profit, non-profit, government, basically really a strategic plan on how can you incorporate these practices. He has a lot of experience, 22 years in that area, so he's going to really be able to kind of touch on that collaboration piece. We have a panel on discussing the pathway between policy and renewable energy adaptation. We're going to have Mr. Bill Cosby, and he's from Arkansas Public Policy Panel, and he has been kind of working with it within that area in conjunction kind of with Frank Kelly, who is also kind of a advocate in relation to policy and encouraging what can Arkansas do, not so much alleviate the upfront costs on organizations and want to implement practices, but what can we do to kind of encourage it, where it can facilitate the state as well as individuals.
The Delta Green Community Forum, Visions of Green Jobs and Renewable Energy, organized by the Delta Citizens Alliance, will take place Friday, June 28th at East Arkansas Community College in Forest City. The event begins at 8:30 a.m. and runs until 3:30 p.m. Free and open to the public, this forum is for anyone interested in Arkansas's green economy in both the Delta and beyond. You can keep up to date with the latest developments on the group's Facebook page at Delta Green Community Forum. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motes.
The forum in Forest City is sponsored by Alt Consulting, Arkansas Wildlife Federation, and the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation. Meredith Martin-Motes is the founder and editor of the blog The Boiled Down Juice, and you can find out more by visiting boileddownjuice.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back.
Good to be back.
All right. I'm gonna bring you up a name, Richard Nixon. We're hearing a lot about Richard Nixon, as in this administration is very Nixonian.
We've talked about him in the past, and it is something that we've talked about in the terms of Nixonian being a word that has a meaning. And if you're a president, the last thing you want to have happen is to become, you know, a verb or a gerund.
Right.
And it seems to be the last stop in the ad hominem attack train right before you're no better than Hitler.
Right, right. When you're throwing out those, hurling those insults or those comparisons, yes. Now, you have a different take, I think, on why, as to use his own phrase, he's back.
I do. Nixon sits at the outer limits of our general living historical knowledge. He belongs to a generation that is, as we speak, beginning to pass, the greatest generation. And his political career impacted the next generation that is beginning to wane, the baby boomers. He is a part of history, thus a mystery to Generation X and Y, and something that we're just beginning to study in high school history for the millennials.
So the difference between Richard Nixon and, say, JFK or Eisenhower is we have less important figures like a Bob Woodward or a Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation who can give a personal point of view on current events related back to the former president. How does that relate to younger generations?
Well, you know, when we were in high school
and the dinosaurs were roaming the earth, yes.
Yes. Many of our modern American history courses would end after the Second World War,
oh, and
perhaps the Cold War, the 1950s.
We would have to race to get to the Second World War. It seems like we'd be colonial, but yes, that's where the latest you would get to.
Exactly, and that was in part because teaching it had not been really studied in those recent years of the instructors we had, so it's almost like you have a time lag in what's going on.
Sure.
So today, you're seeing the same thing happening, but it's Nixon and Watergate that seem to be that dividing line that happens just short of Reagan, as we see young people beginning to receive that survey course of American history.
So you get up to?
You get up to Nixon.
Okay. Fascinating. But what does this at all have to do with the current media and political climate?
Well, twofold. First, the Nixon you don't know can hurt you. And second, and perhaps more controversial, Richard N. Nixon is the most important American political figure in the second half of the 20th century.
Okay. All right. This will, okay, yes. You've made some people spit out whatever they were drinking right now. Nixon is the most important political figure in the second half of the 20th century in the U.S.
Well, this relates to part two and part one, okay? Mm-hmm. I didn't say Richard Nixon was to be admired.
Yes, right.
Not to be some model for future administrations. Not the greatest standard bearer of the GOP, like, say, a Lincoln or a Reagan.
Yes, you don't see his posters at the conventions,
no,
do you?
No, you don't. But the most important figure. Without Richard Nixon, there is no George W. Bush or Barack Obama.
Okay. You've got the rope. I'm going to let you go. Let's hear this thesis.
Okay. Starting with his service in the Second World War, Nixon is a political zealot that works his way into every important issue of what we fondly call the American century. He created the current level of the imperial presidency, and last of all, his political agendas on domestic policy are responsible for more of the federal government than any of the presidents since the Roosevelts, either Theodore or Franklin.
All right, let's take the zealot angle that
okay.
It was kind of connected to all these things.
All right, so let's think about it. He begins his career as a junior U.S. representative that gets assigned to the HUAC Committee, House of Un-American Activities.
True.
Right?
Okay.
And his involvement with Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers wraps him up in the Red Scare.
Yes.
He becomes vice president for Eisenhower and finds himself for the first time in political jeopardy over campaign funding. He escapes it by using television and the Checkers speech, the original mea culpa online.
With the dog.
That's right.
Checkers was the dog, and yes, this was given to my family, but yes.
Yep.
Sort of I didn't inhale.
That's right. See how it begins to weave forward? His foreign policy with Khrushchev as the vice president, getting involved in the kitchen debate
right.
and becoming a player on the national scene. The 1960 election with JFK, not taking his voter fraud charges public to fight the election result.
And then 4 decades later, Al Gore would fight it.
Yes. See how Nixon becomes a cautionary tale for the next generations. Either avoid what he did or don't make the same mistake, depending on your point of view.
And there are many in either of the major political parties that say he's no role model in any form.
True. But let's consider the past few men to occupy the White House. All of them believed in a strong executive branch, that the president should lead the national agenda, legislative as well as spiritual, and the old, as Teddy Roosevelt liked to say, bully pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
That he has extremely broad powers in foreign policy and as the commander-in-chief.
So there are things a president can do that we can't because it's not illegal when the president does it?
And in that most extreme and controversial expression of what we historically call the imperial presidency, that's what Nixon said to justify anything that he needed to do. It's not illegal when the president does it. Jimmy Carter would begin his administration as a distinct attempt to repudiate all of that.
Well, and yes, he was coming right after the Nixon-Agnew-Ford era.
True. But even he, by the close of his one administration, was taking actions via executive order like any of the other imperial presidents.
And we haven't looked back since.
No, we haven't.
Okay, so you had the zealot part where he was connected to history. You have the imperial presidency. He's kind of given birth to that. What was the third part of your?
Well, this is where we get a very quick overview of the Nixon you don't know, relating back to my first point. Domestic
oh, yes.
scandals, using the FBI to investigate political and cultural opponents, sending the IRS after enemies, setting up the literal enemies list, political dirty tricks that sloughed off into illegal activity. That's all well known.
Right.
But how much do you remember of Richard Nixon's domestic agenda? Get out your pens and papers and your Scantrons.
Because you and I have not, during these conversations, we've talked about this before, some of the things that came out of the Nixon administration.
Yeah. So which president signed the Clean Water Act?
Well, we know.
That's right.
But it was Nixon.
Who created the EPA?
Nixon.
NOAA.
Nixon.
Which party did the president who created OSHA belong to?
It was the Republican Party. It was Nixon.
It was Nixon. Minority contractor set-asides.
Richard Nixon.
Who was the last president to use wage and price controls on the economy?
I'm guessing that's Nixon.
So we look at just sort of that package of things there, and many of them are attributed to Johnson before or Carter or Clinton after, because those are big government, democratic concepts. No, it was Richard Nixon. Who brought us Title IX?
That was during the Nixon administration.
Who set the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit?
Now, that one, yeah, that's Nixon. And you talk about a nanny state
and political
criticism.
And people swear that was Jimmy Carter.
They do, yes. Yes.
Most, if not all of those, are going to be ascribed to Carter or Clinton. Those, a little bit to, you know, you sort of reach at Johnson, but I mean, you see clearly there. So, Len, the man who ended the manned space flight program to the moon at NASA.
Nixon?
As he sat there outside that airstream and smiled and inherited the mantle of JFK's desire to get to the moon by the end of the decade, he was canceling the follow-on Apollo missions because he didn't believe in it. But at the same time, who then told NASA that they needed to start down the road of a space shuttle program?
Richard Nixon.
That would be Nixon. So who turned the post office into a private corporation?
Nixon.
Created the ATF and began the war on drugs.
See, and I think a lot of people would think that that might be Reagan, but it was Nixon.
Well, while Nancy might have told you to just say no to drugs, it was Richard Nixon that was giving a badge to Elvis Presley,
well, that's
remember,
a good point.
And bringing him into that fight against this.
That's true.
Which, you know, that's always one of the most humorous moments. You're asking him to help on drugs, but what?
Yes.
What, these kind of small government cutbacks are often seen as Reagan era, like you said, or law and order conservative Republicans. So, you know, all of these decisions, though, have a through line. They led to parts of the federal government that are with us today, most of them attached to the executive branch, which expanded the discretion and power of, again, the president, thus that growth of the imperial presidency.
So the EPA, the National NOAA, the weather, OSHA, Title IX, all of that goes back to Nixon.
It does. And then, then you add on his foreign policy side, you know, relations with what we then called mainland or communist China, his escalation into and then retreat from Vietnam, his use of covert activities in support of conventional operations. You know, a lot of people will give sort of Nixon his due for detente and the things he did with Henry Kissinger and the way they massaged the world and reset things. Now, if you take all of those things together, you can see, I hope, this is where I'm going with my point of him being, you may not like him, but he is the most consequential figure.
Much broader, much more lasting impact than you realize.
Correct. And now let's take all his negatives.
Mm-hmm.
When you consider that the large parts of current federal election laws were a result of Richard Nixon's excesses, intelligence gathering limits, Richard Nixon's excesses, the War Powers Act, Richard Nixon excesses, and all these other changes of how government has to be limited in direct response to his abuses, we live in a country that is shaped by the 37th President of the United States, for better or for worse.
Well, until G. Gordon Liddy from the dead taps our phones.
We're history.
This Week in This American Life, the truly incredible story of a guy who started a list of hundreds of Iraqis who needed to get out of their country. They were getting death threats. He was their only hope. And he was 26, living in his aunt's basement, had no idea what to do to help them. How he kind of succeeded spectacularly and failed spectacularly both at the same time this week.
This American Life, Saturday mornings at 6 and Sunday mornings at 10, following Weekend Ozarks at Large, here on KUAF 91.3 FM. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 15th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series begins July 13th with American bebop and jazz pianist, composer, and singer Bob Doro. The series will continue with the Composer Showcase July 27th and the Amina Figueroa Quintet on August 16th. Tickets and more information are available online at KUAF.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Barling.
I don't know where Barling is.
Barling's just almost next door to Fort Smith.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
A couple of programming notes that we want to remind you about.
Yes.
Tomorrow is the final edition of Talk of the Nation. Mm-hmm. It's leaving KUAF's airwaves because it's leaving everybody's airwaves. Mm-hmm. The show has been, I don't know what term you want to use. They say it's not a cancellation, but, I mean, it's not going to be on anymore. So
I don't know what else to call
NPR
it.
Is ceasing production of the program.
There you go.
Now, Science Friday.
We'll continue on Fridays.
Yes, so we'll still have Science Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But Monday through Thursday, beginning Monday, will be a new, kind of new way of the program Here and Now being developed. It's now a co-production of WBUR and NPR.
Oh.
So you're going to hear a lot of NPR voices on it. It's a news magazine. Mm-hmm. It's not the same format as Talk of the Nation.
Okay.
I think it's going to be much more recognizable as a news magazine format like Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Okay.
So you'll have a news magazine in
the
middle
of the day. So as opposed to like call-in.
Exactly.
Okay. That's the big difference here.
Now, Science Friday we'll still have on Friday, and that will still have its same format.
Sure.
But Here and Now will begin Monday 1 to 3.
And we've had Here and Now on one of our HD channels, correct?
HD 3.
So
correct.
Some people may be familiar with it
exactly.
from there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so that'll be on every day, 1 to 3, beginning on Monday.
Okay.
You went to the Texas League All-Star Game at Arbus Ballpark last night.
I did. It was a good time. Got there for the Home Run Derby, and that was fun. Trying to think. It was a guy from the North that won. Naturals won.
Yeah.
Player won.
Hit 26
Matt
home runs.
Fields,
yep.
I believe,
yep.
was the winner. So that was a lot of fun. Something I've always seen on TV or something. So it was really cool to actually be like, sit there and see it fly by.
How is that in person? Because in television, the first couple of years they brought in the Home Run Derby to the Major League All-Star Game, it was kind of exciting. And now I find it quite boring. How mm-hmm. was it in person?
I mean, I thought it was a fun in person, but maybe it was one of those things that it was the first time I went, so I was really
right.
excited about it. I mean, I wasn't nearly as excited as the children that were on the field.
Oh, sure.
Because they had
right.
the kids that got to run around yeah. and, like, catch the ball and stuff. A couple of those balls were a little treacherous, and it made me nervous that these, like, seven-year-olds might take a ball to the face or something. So I was a little concerned there. But
playing the role of Kyle Kellum in the ballpark was Antoinette Grajeda.
Well, there were a couple of, you know, they right. don't always go where you want them to go. They toss you right. an easy pitch so you can hit it because the point is to get the home run and whatnot.
Right.
So, no, that was fun. That was a lot of fun. And then the game itself, it's interesting because I think something that I asked, and maybe you know the answer to this, mm-hmm. How do they communicate? Because, I mean, on teams you have signals and stuff, but everybody has different signals. And these are all players from different teams.
No, but you set your signals, whether it's an all-star roster or a normal team, you set your signals before the game. You have
okay.
meetings. And so it's not that difficult.
I was just curious.
So you set up your system like, okay, it's going to be the third thing that I do. So mm-hmm. after I hit the shin guard or whatever, or the if I put two in.
Yeah.
Because sometimes pitchers and catchers will change signals in the middle of an at-bat.
Okay.
So it's not that difficult. You just have to know the code.
Okay. I was just curious because I was like, I'm sure everybody has their own code. So when you've got someone from Corpus Christi talking to someone
sure. you just set that up before the game.
San Antonio. Okay. I was just curious. So, yeah, the game was fun, getting to see a bunch of different players because I hadn't seen a lot of them, actually, from different teams.
Keep a list of who you saw because
uh-huh.
a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them will be major
right.
leaguers in a few years.
Right, for sure. So, yeah, it was fun. I'm sorry that the North lost.
That's the team represented by Northwest Arkansas, North
Tulsa.
Little Rock, Springfield, and Tulsa.
Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, there were fireworks, and I had an ice cream sandwich, so I think I was consoled.
Were you there early enough to get the commemorative cap?
I was not.
Ah, sorry.
It's okay.
Want to also remind you that I will be emceeing Summer Salsa to benefit Children's House. That
Saturday.
Is Saturday night at the Town Center in Fayetteville from 7 until 10. Lee and the Mojo Doctors, they're providing the music as well.
Excellent. And I know there was some music you were excited about that's coming up soon as well.
Yes, at the Fayetteville Public Library, Farmer Jason, who's an Emmy winner uh-huh. for a special that he did, he used to be the leader of Jason the Scorchers. When I was in college,
yes.
they were one of the favorite bands among my group of friends, kind of a mixture of punk, country, just kind of loud, fun. And so I'm very excited that he's going to be here, even if it's not with Jason the Scorchers.
Okay, well, something to look forward to.
Yeah, that's July 10th.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Have a good day.